for anyone who might wish to share what it was like if you chose to do that exercise during our sitting to sort of trot out all the dirty laundry. How was it to, you know, to just say, okay, well, you know, if I was really onto this, if I really had it together, this is what I would be doing. This is how it would be. What did you learn from doing that exercise?
The first thing that came up for me is the phrase, I would never act impulsively if I were a good yogi.
There you go. Right. Nice work if you can get it. I like it. So, other stuff. Anybody else want to throw something into the pot?
Yes. Lloyd, I would say for me, came up first was I always get have torpor and sleepiness in meditation.
Yes.
You know, and then also I have thoughts of ill will, you know, so those are the two that came up for me.
Yeah, good. Okay, and thank you. Appreciate that. Others who might want to share something. Hello?
Hi. What I came up with was if I were a better yogi, I would find myself sitting for hours on end in complete joy and relaxation.
There you go. Shangri-La. Absolutely. You know. Well, you know, it's easy to relate to, because when the Buddha hung out his shingle, he said, you know, he's talking about freedom from dukkha, and he's talking about states of deep peace of mind and self-acceptance and openness to all. And so, I mean, it's great rap, right? So he said, yeah, I want some of that. So you sign up, and then you start doing the practice, and all of a sudden, that's not where you're getting served. Right? It's like, all right, well, this is what I thought I was going for, and this is what's happening. So what's going on here? You know, either I got sold a line of goods, or maybe I'm not equal to this, or somewhere along the line, something went off the rails. But in fact, exactly what we're talking about is exactly one of the things the Buddha said that arises when we begin to inquire into, you know, how does the mind create suffering? So yeah, I thank you so much, you know, because that's right, just, please continue.
Anything else I thought of? You know, it was on the background of you suggesting if I were a better yoga. A yogi, which is like fundamentally askew. So it was with a lot of humor. Anything that came up.
Well done.
It's like, yeah. Okay.
Exactly. You know what we're doing in that exercise is inviting the judgmental, discursive mind to come forth and strut its stuff. You know, and just kind of lay it all out there, you know, sort of like for the prosecution and the court of the Queen of Hearts, you know, kind of. And then at some point, like you said, if you just kind of listen to the voice after a while, there can arise, if you're not taking it too seriously, just this, it's like a sort of sense of humor, you know, and you can see what the discursive mind is up to, you know, that, you know, well, this is what I think the perfect yogi ought to look like and how I ought to be behaving and whatnot. And then it becomes possible to just, I don't know, a little, to bring to it just a little bit of compassion, humor. Right, okay, well, here we are. It's what the mind does sometimes. And so I guess we got to take that in. And that's another useful aspect of the exercise. because in addition to ferreting out all these things, you know, that we wish were different about ourselves, at the end of the day, what it also does is to make it possible to look at the state of mind that wishes that we were different than we are.
And right, it's me on a pedestal.
Exactly, you know. And that means we're getting pretty close to the center of the onion, you know, as the Buddha talked about it, because we're really having an opportunity to get in touch, hopefully, like you said, in kind of a, you know, a humorous, gentle, kind way with that part of the mind that wants us to be different than we are. And that is really getting pretty close to the core of what the Buddha was talking about when he talked about Buddha nature being the arising of wisdom and compassion. You know, because we're starting to get a little bit of insight into how the mind, the discursive mind, is trying to tell us how to be a better yogi. And we see the futility of that. And then when that occurs, then there can just be this gentle sense of forgiveness and compassion as, oh, okay, so that's how it is, right?
Thank you. So,
yeah. In some ways, that's the whole nature of the exercise. It's just to say, yeah, well, you know, it's what the discursive mind does. And it is a really important area of activity of the mind that it's worth really bringing into focus and coming into a closer and more compassionate relationship to, because when the Buddha was striving toward perfection of mind and freedom from suffering and all that, he came pretty close to killing himself toward the end of his quest, because he was so ardently fixed upon freedom from suffering, but it was the discursive mind's obsession with findings and finding a means of being free from suffering. Very nearly starved himself to death, and then ultimately realized that it was a self-defeating path that he was on, and that it was his own craving and clinging for something the discursive mind told him he should be able to achieve that he couldn't. That was ultimately the source of his suffering. It's the second noble truth, you know, craving and clinging as the ultimate source of all suffering. And so when he began to, when he had that insight, then he sat down, he had some, you know, somebody offered him something to eat, and he kind of chilled out a little while, and he realized the importance of there being a kind of an element of compassion in what he was doing. And then that began to allow the ultimate unfolding. And so that was his path. But once he began to teach, to share his experience with others on how to achieve freedom of mind, at least what the texts tell us is, and now I'm drawing this from a book by Bhante Anolio on the greater discourse on the foundations of mindfulness. He said that a lot of the Buddha's early and really ardent monastics found themselves falling into the same trap that he did in terms of enlightenment or bust, you know, and they were just practicing so incessantly and so vigorously that when they got to somewhat the same point he did, which is this profound aversion to the activities of the discursive mind, what happened for him was that he had the insight that craving and clinging, the state of enlightenment, was in fact the ultimate source of suffering. they didn't quite get that. They wound up committing suicide instead, because it was the only way they could figure out to stop the craving and clinging, you know, the discursive mind's incessant search for enlightenment. And at that point, the Buddha realized he'd kind of overdone it. You know, he said, I've been talking a lot about striving and, you know, fervent practice and all that, but I have really been not putting enough emphasis on kindness toward oneself and on practicing without attachment to outcome. And so he dialed it back, and he really began to kind of modify and soften his teaching a little bit, because he didn't want people getting into the same kind of trouble that he did. And so that's why these teachings, and again, in the Theravada, they're called the Paramis, and in Mahayana, the Paramitas. The translation of the word is usually the perfections. And they're not emphasized a lot, especially on the front end of people taking up Dharma practice, because of the danger, or the very kind of issue that he found himself falling into, and also some of those earliest followers, which is to say, if you are taking up these teachings from the standpoint of I am going to become a perfect yogi, you know, by virtue of cultivating these qualities, that's a really dangerous and painful and destructive path to follow. That it's the ego's, the discursive mind's sense of perfectionism that is really, in some ways, at the core of the problem. And so, in my own study and, you know, scholarship on the topic, reflection on it, and some of the other things I've read, I'm not so sure that perfections is the best translation of parami or paramita. And instead, I'm more inclined to use a term, something like refinements. You know, Jack Kornfield, in his teachings, he also talks about this tendency of mind. He said, you know, the problem is that the discursive mind wants to be present for its own funeral. It wants to be around for the experience of becoming enlightened, yeah. Or as I sometimes put it, you know, the great cosmic practical joke of the Dharma is that it creates in the self a desire to be free of self, you know, which is, it turns out, not really how it works. What I found to be, and you know, and what I've learned from teachers, my own teachers, is, including my teaching mentor, Joseph Goldstein, is that the problem that arises when we're taking up something like the study of the perfections, refinements, is that the mind inevitably approaches them from the perspective of I. How do I practice these perfections, rather than how do we recognize them when they arise? So in the Theravada, there are 10 of them. In the Mahayana, there are 6. And so this evening, just to sort of keep things simple and straightforward, I want to start off with a Mahayana list, and then next time we get together, I can add on the other one. How to best understand these teachings about the perfections, what they mean. And, you know, the Buddha used a lot of similes in his teachings, and One of the ones that he would use sometimes was when he had one of the similes he used was that of the mind as the discursive mind as like an iron ball, like a ball of iron ore that a metalsmith wants to make something with. But in order to do that, the metalsmith needs to take this hard, cold ball of iron ore and put it in a furnace and to gradually apply more and more and more intense levels of heat to it. So I said, you can think about the mind as this cold, hard iron ball, and that when you begin to meditate intensively, that the powers of concentration, the powers of mindfulness are like fuel, both the flames and the fuel for the flames that are all directed at this iron ball that gradually begin to soften it and expand it and make it malleable and glowing and gold and fluid, so that you can then make of that fluid mass what you will. You can shape it to the form that you want it to take. And using that simile, the Buddha also talked about, you know, like when you're smelting ores, precious metal ores like gold or silver, or, you know, the common ones like iron or whatever, that when you put the ore into a furnace, what you do is to apply this intense heat in this confined space. And that what gradually begins to happen is that the impurities, you know, the dirt and the grit and the cow dung or whatever is mixed in with the ore, burns off, until what's left at the end of the process is the purity or the essence, you know. So you take the raw ore and you refine it. And so that's why I like more to use the term refinements, you know. And so what the Buddha said, and when these teachings on the perfections occur in the Kuddhika Nikaya mostly, which is, you know, it's sort of the book of everything else rather than the connected discourses or the long discourses. And basically he was telling stories about how it was that he approached the state of awakening. And so he said, as he applied, you know, concentration and mindfulness to his consciousness, that it became apparent that other things, the dross burned away, and it became apparent that there were certain things, certain qualities of mind that were really carrying him along or taking him where he needed to go. One was just the power of concentration itself. He came to have tremendous respect for the mind's ability just to gather itself and have a really hard look at what was going on in the mind on a moment-to-moment basis. And then he said the second one that really struck him, that really occurred to him, was courage. And he said that when you really have a hard look at everything that's going on in the mind, you know, as all these impurities, these imperfections, these things begin to burn off, and you see them, and you say, ew, that really? Was that in there? You know, that there is, that it can be a little frightening or disturbing to see some of the things that arise out of your own consciousness, you know, that you know have caused yourself and others harm in the past. And he said, it really requires courage to be able to just be with everything that comes up in the mind. And in Bodhidharma, there's a distinction that's made, certainly that I find to be a useful one, between fearlessness and courage. So fearlessness, I have a dear friend who wrote a book about the meditative absorptions, the jhanas, deep samadhi, Shaila Catherine, and the title of her book is Focused and Fearless. But fearless is the absence of fear. It's not feeling any anxiety or any fear. Courage is different than that in my experience. It's different from that in my experience as a yogi, you know, as a student and practitioner of Buddha Dharma. It's also different in my experience as a combat veteran from my time in Vietnam. And so for me, courage is not really the absence of fear. What it is the presence of faith, faith in oneself, faith in the Dharma, whatever, the combination of faith and equanimity, certain presence and peacefulness of mind in the presence of fear. So it's not like fear is absent. It's like there's this field in which there is fear, there is faith, and there is equanimity. There's a certain peace of mind, right? And the courage is the ability to be with the fear in an unswerving way, you know? So, concentration, courage. Third of these qualities of mind that come forth in the furnace, right? That are born out of the crucible. Integrity of being, sometimes also called silar, ethics and morality. It's like there's the realization that, almost warrior-like, that to be present for, to conduct oneself in a way that's going to lead to freedom, requires a certain integrity of being, you know, and that's listed in the precepts as, you know, things like not needlessly taking life, not taking that which is not given, not engaging in sexual misconduct, being truthful, maintaining clarity of mind, living with integrity. Okay. So, concentration, courage, integrity of mind and behavior. Generosity, the natural inclination to give of oneself as we can, of just being there for others as it is within our capacity to do so, right? To help others out as we can. Patience. In 2012, my wife Abby and I had an opportunity to live for a period of time in Catalonia and in southeastern or eastern Spain, Mediterranean Spain, when I was on a visiting faculty at the University of Barcelona. And my host there on the law faculty was also the advisor to a Tibetan monastery on the Catalonian coast, southeast of Barcelona. He took us there, and we spent a weekend, and I'd been asked to give a Dharma talk on the founding of Spirit Rock Meditation Center, since they were in the process of developing their center. And we were in their bookstore, and among the things they had for sale, it was a little set of kind of like refrigerator magnets, except our refrigerator is made out of aluminum, so we put them on our pot rack. But what it was these little magnets that had the Spanish words for the six paramitas, you know. So every morning when I go out to cook something, I'd see concentración, you know, coraje, ética y moral, generosidad, paciencia, sabiduría, the six paramitas, generosity, you know, paciencia. Usually it translates as patience, right? Thich Nhat Hanh, the Mahayana Zen master, Vietnamese Zen master, is giving a talk on the paramitas once, and said, you know, in terms of, said this word patience, he said, I tend not to use that word so much. And he said, the reason is because patience connotes waiting for something to happen. Sitting around waiting for things to get better, right? And he said, I think better, you know, and in this case, it's like sitting around waiting to become enlightened or whatever, you know, or just not, you know, making the idea is to let things unfold at their own pace, you know, as they will, rather than grasping for a result. But he said he thinks that a better or more skillful interpretation or translation of that particular paramita is what he calls constancy. Now, which is to say, just stay at it. Just stay at it. You know, if things aren't moving along as quickly as you think they ought to, or you're not achieving some goal at the rate you think you should be, that patience is a little too passive. You know, he felt that it's like if you're on some slog in the backcountry, you know, and it's getting late in the day and carrying a pretty heavy load and whatnot. If you sit down by the side of the trail, and you cultivate patience, it's not really going to get you where you need to go. You know? He said, instead, there needs to be this sense of staying with it, being with it, and doing so in a way that's patient or measured, or that's not fixated on some result, but that nonetheless maintains the forward momentum. Now just be constant about what you're doing. Don't get frustrated or give up, you know, if things aren't moving as quickly as you think they ought to, or you're not achieving some goal as fully or as quickly as you want to. He said that that's not really how it works. You do your part and the Dharma does its part, and then things unfold as they should. So constancy or paciencia. Sabiduría, the Spanish word translates as wisdom. And wisdom in these teachings of the paramitas, is what begins to emerge as all of the others become more manifest, you know, as the concentration, the courage, the behaving with integrity, the generosity, the patience, as they begin to sort of manifest themselves. You know? And by this, it's not something like where you go get a jar of, you know, patience off the shelf and mix water, and then you've got patience, you know, or constancy. It's like by virtue of the efforts of concentration and mindfulness and whatnot, you know, the furnace, these things naturally begin to manifest and they begin to reveal themselves. And as they do, we recognize them. Say, oh, okay, the mind is calm, the mind is concentrated. Oh, here's some really awful stuff that I just unfolded about myself or my history or somebody else, or things that are frightening, you know, disturbing, anxiety provoking, and yet here I am. Here I am. Here I am with them. The courage, you know. The noting that when you behave with integrity, there's less suffering. That people are more appreciative of your presence, more grateful for who you are in the world, right? When you behave with integrity, when you don't. No. See, when you open your heart, when you share whatever you have to share with others, as it is possible to do, how it makes the heart feel warm, open, how you feel more connected with others. When you feel that sense of right, I'm in this for the long haul. I'll stay with this until it takes me where I need to go. When that's going on, there is this wisdom that arises in the mind. And what wisdom means in this context, or what it means in Buddha Dharma generally, is being able to see all that is happening from the perspective of not self. It's being able to understand, to see the arising of all of these qualities of mind from the perspective of emptiness, right? And when that realization occurs, then what the realization is that all of this is unfolding as it should without me making it do so, without there being an I fabricating all this, without there being an I making all this happen, that it is in fact unfolding and manifesting just as it was meant to, right? So that wisdom of emptiness that ultimately becomes sort of the reaffirming perspective that lets us know we're on the path. So these perfections, these refinements, are not accomplishments of the discursive mind. And in fact, they happen almost in spite of it. They happen just through observation. They happen through the practice of constancy. They happen through realization and insight that occurs quite irrespective of what the discursive mind thinks ought to be going on. So that's the shtick. That's the short version, the Mahayana side of it. And I would really love to participate in some discussion, any thoughts or reflections or questions that anybody has regarding anything I've said. Let's dive in.
Hello, Lloyd. I was wondering if persistence would also be a useful term to replace constancy.
Yeah, it could be. It just means keep on keeping on.
Exactly.
That's it. Yeah. I think that the original translation was just like to say, you know, and Ajahn Chah, the Thai Force meditation master, said this too. He said, you know, it's like if you're, and Buddha used the term all the time, cultivation. He said, you know, you put the, you plant the seeds in the ground, you till the soil, you bring amendments, you add water, and there's sunlight. And he said, you've done what you can do. You've done your part. And then, you know, the cosmos does, nature does the rest. And you can't, you know, farmers can't make plants leap out of the ground. You know, you do what you do in partnership with nature. And so, yeah, that's a good one. It's like cultivation, you know, like gardening. You know, if you just say, okay, well, good luck, seeds, you know, probably there isn't going to be good luck. You know, there needs to be tending. There needs to be, you know, turning the soil from time to time. There needs to be adding amendments. There needs to be watering. There needs to be chasing away the pests. But then with that kind of consistent effort, that kind of constancy, that kind of persistence, then whatever's going to unfold, unfolds. Yeah. Good. Thanks. Anybody else want to chip in?
Let's see.
Karen, please. Unmute, Karen. Okay.
Yeah. Would you talk on the role of perfection? You've touched on sort of the maybe misinterpretation or misuse or beating up ourselves. And yet it seems like the whole path, if it's guided by awakening, is that not the result of having perfected ourselves, purified ourselves? I'm not sure what other words would apply in some form. So how does that fit together?
Oh yeah, I mean, here we are. Yeah, we've been wrestling with this for 2,500 years now.
Yeah. Sorry, can you give me an answer right now?
Oh no. I mean, it's the warp and woof of the Dharma. You know, we've been having this talk for 2,500 years, and with any luck, we'll have it for another 2,500 years. And it falls into the realm of what the Buddha called effortless effort. You know, I'm drawing a lot to the teachings that occurred when there were several efforts to bring Buddha Dharma into China, but the one that seemed to really bloom or manifest or yield the greatest fruits was when it finally became really admixed with Taoism. And then China became Zhuan Buddhism, which when it went to Japan and Korea, it came to be called Zen. But it was this notion of the liberation of mind being no different from the natural world manifesting itself, right? And that, so that a lot of the Taoist teachings segued perfectly with a lot of the Buddha Dharma that came at the time, because what Taoism was teaching was, you don't decide what to do, you discern the flow of the Tao. and you align yourself with that flow. And so, especially in the Mahayana take on the teachings of the Buddha, it's not like at the relative level down here, it feels like the discursive mind is making decisions about what should I say or what should I not say? How should I act or how should I not act? You know, how should I comport myself in the world so as to be a better yogi? You know, or you know, to not act in a way that that creates more suffering. But this kind of alternative view is one where all we're really seeking to do is to discern the natural inclinations of mind. In other words, to discern, to uncover, to become one with the Buddha nature that's within us. And hang on a second, I've got a reading, if I can pull it up, from Joseph Goldstein that goes straight at this. Joseph was in his book One Dharma. You know, it was a book in which he, like a lot of us, had spent time with Theravada Buddhist teachers in Asia, with Zen teachers, with Rinpoche's and the Vajrayana tradition. And when he wrote this book, One Dharma, what he was trying to do is to reconcile all these different paths and how they seem to have different things to say about the nature of enlightenment, about the path to enlightenment, and that he was really feeling sort of torn in several different directions. And so he was, in his book, he was talking about, you know, he was really wrestling with this stuff. And he was doing a retreat with a Dzogchen master, Nyoshul Khin Rinpoche. And it was going very much to the question or the issue that you just raised, you know. Is the path of the arahat, the one, you know, who is following the path of restraint in the Theravada tradition, making these judgments at each fork in the road, and at each fork in the road, the idea is you unburden yourself a little more of self in the path to awakening, or more in the Mahayana picture, it's more simply relaxing into or simply opening to the manifestation of wisdom and compassion that happens quite naturally within. And he said, when I was hearing Rinpoche's teachings on compassion and emptiness, there was an unexpected moment of insight as I realized that the relative level is the expression of the ultimate. Compassion is the activity of emptiness. Suddenly the great and seemingly impossible burden of someone having to save all beings dissolved into the great expansive arena of selfless compassionate action. Compassionate action is the natural responsiveness of awareness free of self. There is no one doing anything. So in this model or this way of understanding, even though at one level it seems like we are making decisions on a moment-to-moment, day-to-day basis, if we're fussing with our spouse or, you know, haggling over a phone bill or, you know, talking to the neighbor about their barking dog or whatever it is that's going on, that it seems like, you know, we are down here in the trenches and we're and we're doing our best. You know, we're doing our best within the confines of the discursive mind to try to live out, you know, these perfections or whatever. But there is this alternative view or alternative way of understanding that in some ways is very much, I think it's fair to say, is faith-based, which is just to say, if we are doing our part, if we are doing what we can in terms of practicing, inquiring into the nature of the Dharma, watching carefully the ways of the mind, cultivating as we can qualities of compassion and, you know, selfless joy, that there is this guidance system of which we have little or no deep understanding that is in fact taking care of us. That there is, you know, as the awakening occurs, that the simultaneous, that as the mind becomes more and more tuned to not self, as the mind becomes more and more attuned to nobody home, there's nobody really running the show. Instead of everything just becoming chaos and uncontrolled, unskillful behavior, what happens instead as the mind relaxes into this really deep faith, it's in the Sensen Ming, it's called Verses on the Faith Line. As we relax more and more into that understanding of the selfless nature of all phenomena and the selfless nature of our very own being, then what naturally occurs is that compassion kicks in. If there is no self, there is no one to be protected. There is no one to direct action. There is no one to do this or that or the other thing. But as we relax into that state of not-self, of non-being, of emptiness, that this force, this quality of, and it's what in the Mahayana is called the great mind or Buddha mind, that this quality of compassionate intention simply flows forth. And that becomes kind of the guidance system for what carries us forward. So that is the understanding, that's the framework, that, you know, when we get in trouble, when we're working with doing, you know, like practices like the perfections or even trying to cultivate the Brahma Viharas or the quality, you know, the seven factors of enlightenment, that when it becomes difficult or confining or frustrating is when it's coming from the place of, I am cultivating these things, or I'm trying to cultivate these things, and I'm not doing nearly as good a job of it as I think I should be, right? And so that's where it gets hard. That's where it gets, you know, difficult and sometimes, you know, a little disappointing. And what this alternative perspective is suggesting, and that's how, it's one way that this look at the perfections can be a little illuminating, actually a little freeing, is when we stop thinking about them as something that we need to attain, and rather think about them as things that naturally arise as the flame and fuel in the furnace of mindfulness and concentration that applied to the mind burn away the other stuff. And so all that's left is this impetus, you know, is the concentration, the courage, the honorable behavior, the patience, the wisdom, ultimately the wisdom, Prajna Paramita is what it's called in the Mahayana, that is actually sort of running the show. So, very, very long, elaborate answer to a very short, simple question. I hope it was responsive.
I will try to take it in.
Yeah, and a lot of this, you know, I reread the big portions of Joseph's book, One Dharma, today, which is one of those touchstones. It's one of the ones I go back to a lot, because he does, in my experience and view, a really nice, really nice job of integrating the two perspectives.
I'll look back on that because we have that too. Thank you. Thanks, Jeff.
If I could just add on to that. First of all, thank you, Karen, for the question. It was so helpful. Something has been floating around my head for a long time, and I've never seen it brought up here, so I'm really happy about that. I was thinking of an Ajahn Amaro talk that I listened to a few months ago, so it's a little hazy, but he was saying that the remarkable ability for a mind that's mundane, you know, and very full of hindrances, to find something that is really profound. And he said it was, the word he used is like the good, this nature that, and I, that struck me also as something that I heard in the Mahayana traditions, is this Buddha nature, but I really liked hearing it from a Theravada master.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you could maybe point me towards some reading on that from like the Pali Canon, or maybe it was kind of a synthesis.
Oh no, I don't know if you've come across it. Many years ago, Ajahn Amaro co-taught a meditation retreat at Spirit Rock, I think it was at least a good 15 years or so ago. He co-taught a retreat with Sopni Rinpoche, the Dzogchen master. And it turned out to be one of these kind of sort of historic events, because they're both extraordinarily erudite, skilled teachers, and well versed in their own traditions. And coming out of that retreat, I think based at least part on his talks, Ajahn Amaro wrote a little book. It's called Small Boat, Great Mountain. You may already have it. I don't know. And I'm not quite, I think it was sort of a limited edition thing, but if I were you, I would go to my browser and just put in that title, you know, Small Boat, Great Mountain by Ajahn Amaro. Because he was, and the very title is a play on this interplay between he and Sukhni Rinpoche, because they would take up a similar theme, and then they would like you know, the paramis or the paramitas, and then play with them. You know, they talk about them, you know, where the touch points seem to occur between the two traditions and where they kind of go different directions, but. Yeah, if you can find that, I highly recommend it. Yeah. Also, almost anything you can get your hands on by Bhante Analayo, Analayo. Let me see. I'm trying to think of. He has a book on emptiness. You know, it's the Theravada take on emptiness, or Shunyata. I think you'll probably find some kind of fun stuff in there.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Sarah.
Yep, of course. Anything else come to mind for anybody? Please, Gloria.
Oh, there we go. Thank you, Terrell Lloyd. You used the term alternative view a few times. And I was wondering, alternative to what?
I think when I was using it, it was in reference to alternative perspectives between the Theravada and the Mahayana tradition. Because they, you know, they, it's like if somebody, you know, if you were in an Asian country and somebody asked you, well, what's the Christian point of view on this? It's like, well, duh, you know, that's kind of vast. And the same is certainly true of Buddha Dharma. You know, there are all these different takes on it over the last 2,500 years. And so, but the two kind of major perspectives are the, you know, Theravada or Southern Buddhist and the Mahayana. And so when I use alternative, that's usually what I'm referring to. Now I'm trying to point out areas where the two seem to overlap and where they apparently seem to diverge. Is that responsive?
Yeah, I guess what came to mind was in Western philosophy, one of the big dialogues is between the traditional religious view that embraces dualism. You know, so there's an immaterial God and a material world, and ne'er the twain shall meet. And then a guy named Benedict Spinoza came along and talked about God and the world as one substance. And of course, he was excommunicated after that.
Yeah, right. That's what happens.
An alternative view.
Now they recycle you. Yeah, right.
But it sounded like what you were talking about. So if you accept Spinoza's view that we are part of that one substance that includes God, then my job is not to listen to whomever tell me about what I need to know, but rather to understand my world because I'm a piece of it.
Yes. Thank you so much for spelling that out. And that is also a kind of a point of departure in terms of languaging and I guess to some extent even cosmology, because in the Mahayana tradition and Vajrayana or Tibetan is kind of a part of that greater Mahayana view, there's a lot of talk about the relative and the absolute, like relative bodhicitta and absolute bodhicitta, the quality of the heart mind, as if they were two different realms and simultaneously existing on different planes. And the Theravada view doesn't really go for that so much, right? In terms of, you know, my own teachers like Bhante and Alayo, their view is that instead, rather than being, and this is, you can think of it as being partly cosmological, but you can also think of it just being in terms of how the mind is organizing or trying to organize its take on reality. So, while there's that view in the Mahayana, the relative and the absolute, in the Theravada, you know, it's certainly from scholars like Nalayo and also Joseph Goldstein, actually. He's kind of on the fence, I guess. But certainly Nalayo is that what in the Mahayana is called the relative and the absolute, and the Theravada is different, is basically understood as this just differing levels of concentration, which is to say, down here on Earth, you know, it's like, you know, Ram Dass, I know one time, a long time ago, said, you know, it's fine to talk to God, but don't forget your zip code. You know, it's like you got. It's useful to be able to stay plugged into all these different planes, but in his understanding, you know, or this other way of looking at it, when we are interacting as we are now, using the facilities of discursive mind, languaging and framing and, you know, comparing and analyzing, we're operating, the mind is operating in a mode of functioning that makes it possible for us to have these conversations and whatnot. When one goes into meditation practice, and especially if the mind finds it possible to enter a state of really deep samadhi, as the mind becomes more and more and more calm, and this is something that neuroscientists who've hooked up wiring to people like Lee Brazington and others that are, you know, heavy duty deep samadhi practitioners, that as the mind becomes more and more calm and more at ease and more relaxed, is that essentially what begins to happen is that the mind stops performing certain functions, like telling ourselves who we are, for instance, you know, like organizing the body in terms of space and time, and eventually the mind gets relaxed to the point where it ceases altogether to construct the self. And then it enters into this state of voidness, of emptiness, of kind of union with all that is, in which the self is basically absent. It's not there. It's gone. And then the bell rings. And you come back into the shell of self and the relativity, and I am me and you are you and whatnot, but that it's all happening within the same solid state. So I guess you could say the Theravada view is more like Spinoza. It's like there's no guy in the sky, there's no other place, there's no thing out there. There is only this world that we live in, but we understand it and we relate to it in different ways depending upon how the mind is functioning. So that relate? Is that correct? Okay. Well, good, because we've run over time. Here we are. Bumping up against 8 o'clock. Thank you, everybody, so much for dropping in this evening. It's been nice to hang together and have this conversation, do some practice. And I look forward to seeing you again in a couple of weeks. Maya Kundarma.
Thanks, Lloyd. What would you like to call the talk?
The Perfections.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Tara Lloyd.
Sure.
Thank you.
Night, everybody.
Good night. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Good night.
Good night. Good night.
Thank you, Caroline. Good night, everyone.
Good night, all. Thanks.
Be well.